Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So, Melanie, happy Easter.
Happy Easter. He has risen.
He has risen indeed. So, it is still Easter. It's the octave. It is the 8 days of starting with Easter Sunday that all are liturgically the same day, which means, you know, that for the Easter Friday is a mandatory meat day.
I'm not sure mandatory, but
you have to eat meat at all three meals. Otherwise, you're not properly celebrating the resurrection of the flesh. Or something.
I think you're making that up.
I'm probably making that up.
It is. However, it's interesting to me how, like, praying, when I started praying the Liturgy of the Hours, I started to realize, like, Easter Monday's prayers are exactly the same as Sunday's, and so are Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays and Fridays. Like, it is the same prayers.
Yes.
There's none of the usual variation that you get in a week, which it's kind of disconcerting. It starts to feel almost sometimes monotonous. But there's kind of a joyful monotony of, like, how exciting it is to say Alleluia over and over and over again after 40 days of no Alleluia.
Especially after 40 days of being reminded over and over again, no, you can't say Alleluia at the end of that prayer. It took you a while to get used to that at the beginning of Lent.
Yeah, it's so automatic.
Yes, it is. So let's go back in time.
Right.
Go back, if you will, and imagine, if you can, the beginning of Holy Week.
Unfortunately, Holy Week began with me feeling sick.
Yeah, so you finally got the funk that the rest of us got.
Yeah, and so I dragged myself through Holy Week, sort of gritting my teeth, and then today I collapsed and I slept until 11 this morning.
Yes, and you were still tired all day. Yeah, it's catching up.
I think I need another couple of days of sleeping in and not doing much. Yes. We're taking this as a school vacation week this week, totally. And yeah, we need it.
Take them as we need them. That's the benefits of homeschooling. As we take the weeks as we must. So, but we did start with, besides you getting sick, your sister arrived.
My sister came on Wednesday, and it's great. It's been a year since the last time she was here. And we've missed her greatly. And
there was much rejoicing. Everyone wanted to go with you to the airport shuttle to greet her.
Yeah, it was a full van of kids. Very exciting. It's so nice to have her here. And
she's here partially to visit, but partially because it's this Saturday is Isabella's confirmation, and she's Isabella's sponsor. I think we mentioned that last time. So. We have her here. And what else did we do? So this week, we didn't get to go to Holy Thursday this year.
That was just more than I could handle. We went to Good Friday, but anything that was late in the evening, I just did not feel like I had the energy to do.
Ironically, it was easier when the kids were little, partly because there was fewer of them, when Bella and Sophie were little. But it was just easier for, you know, one of us to sneak out to go, like for me to go or you to go, or to me to take a couple of the older ones. You know what I mean? It's just harder now that they're all older and they're so independent and willful sometimes, and just coaxing them all. Okay, let's go do this thing day after day throughout the Triduum can be hard. So you got to pick your battles.
Yeah. I've been feeling kind of,
and you weren't feeling top of
sick. So I didn't push it. I didn't push myself and I didn't push them. And
it was
fine. We went to Good Friday at 3 PM and
Our Lady of Lourdes, which is not our regular parish, but is in our parish collaborative.
Yeah. And that was nice. And then we just went to Easter Sunday morning. We did not do the vigil or Holy Thursday.
Yeah. But it was the Good Friday was good. It was I have to say, the long services do not feel as long to me as they once did.
Are they not as long anymore as they used to be? Do we just not notice it as much?
I think it's not noticing as much. I mean, it's the same readings. They're doing the same readings that they always did. But when I was younger, they just felt like, even not that long ago, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they just felt a lot longer. I felt a lot like, ugh.
It seemed like that Anthony was feeling like it was lasting a long time. He was struggling.
This is an 11-year-old boy.
Exactly.
And having him sit anywhere for, you know, the length of time is tough for him. But yeah, there was a lot of all of the intercessions with the, you know, the stand, kneel, stand, kneel, stand, kneel.
Yeah, he was really struggling with that. And I remember when I was little, just that being so hard, and it just did not feel hard this year at all.
No. I'm just trying to think of like the different aspects of it. You were saying that they did change one of the songs.
They changed the tune for the reproaches. I'm sure it's a more accurate translation from the Latin, but it's not. It was neither the words nor the tune that I've sung as long as I can remember, and it was jarring and disconcerting, and it made me kind of cranky. You know, like,
yeah,
especially because that's one of my favorite parts of the Good Friday service. And so to have it changed, like not gone, but just changed, it was just
off, just slightly off.
Yeah. I'm getting to be a cranky old woman.
Well, it's Good Friday. You've been fasting. You're hungry.
This is true too.
Yeah.
So my tradition on Good Friday is usually to fast until after the service of the Lord's Passion. And then I usually make hot cross buns in the morning. And so we come home and we have hot cross buns. And that's usually my first food of the day. Which is a long time.
That is a long time. Yes, that is long.
I think I did actually eat a little bit of something before we left, like maybe some apple slices or something small. Not a whole meal, but just like a little snack.
A little blood sugar pump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was.
Yeah. And for me being diabetic, I do the best I can, but I'm not going to literally kill myself or even, you know what I mean? I'm not going to risk anything. I mean, I fast as much as I can, but I'm not doing a 100% fast or anything like that. Like a lot of folks do. I've tried and I get ill and it's not good. It's not just suffering. It's ill. So I do as much as I can. And I think that's between me and God, and we'll hash it out later.
Right.
So Holy Saturday is just that weird day in between where you're like, well, what do we do? there's no like specific prayer service. There's no thing to do. And you're like, we're in between, you know, Good Friday and Easter. It's the almost
kids,
Easter.
Right. With the kids, we always end up dyeing the eggs on Holy Saturday, which gives them structure of a sort.
And for me, I mean, I had recordings all day. I was recording Mysterious World with Jimmy all day. So
I also did a lot of the Easter baking on Saturday.
Yes, you did. We'll talk about some of those yummies in a sec. But yeah, that's.
And all of my baking was sort of, I think you could tell that I was feeling sick while I was baking because everything was just a little bit off. I mean, not bad, just not quite as good as the quality usually is.
Sure. But that night we all got together and I think the kids really all wanted to watch the Easter Vigil from the cathedral in Boston.
Right. We started watching it in 2020 when we couldn't do anything else.
Yeah.
And then last year we also ended up watching the Easter Vigil at the cathedral. And so at this point, you know, if you've done something twice with kids,
tradition,
it's now tradition. So Sophie ended up going to bed. She's an early.
She goes to bed early. She gets up early.
And she does not do well with late nights. So she just went straight to bed after dinner. And she was already feeling really tired that night. Everyone else tried to watch the vigil. And I think Ben fell asleep in the middle of it and then ended up getting up and going to bed. But the other three made it through the whole vigil.
It's the long 7 Old Testament readings before in the dark.
They did not do seven. I think they did 3.
Nevertheless, it is that long period in the dark. I think that it's tough to stay awake for. I sympathize. He's also usually someone who's early to bed, but
he did try. And I think if we had gone to mass, like in person, I think he probably would have made it.
Fine. Yeah.
It's just on TV at home,
hanging out on the futon with a blanket. And yeah, no, the service itself was nice. I was a little surprised at how sparse the attendance at the cathedral was.
I really was surprised. Like it was,
it's usually packed. Like before the 2020, it would have been packed on.
And I'm surprised like people aren't
going back. Again. Yeah. It's weird.
And they only had five baptisms,
five people
coming into sacraments. The church. I don't think even all five of them were baptized. It was
five Easter sacraments.
Like our parish had more than the cathedral, which was unusual.
Our parish had 50, or our collaborative had 15 altogether. Our parish alone, I think, had 8. Right.
Right.
So it was. But Cardinal Sean is good as always. I noticed him having a little more trouble than usual reading his homily. I think the eyes are starting to get
He's getting older.
They got to start printing out his homily a little larger type.
But it's nice. The music is always nice.
And I love. So they have a variety of musical accompaniment for the Psalms. And I love the Mexican group that they have too.
The Cardinal's masses are always bilingual, English and Spanish. They always just do a really lovely job with the Spanish music.
There's very few times where I'm good with guitar for liturgical music for mass, but the Mexican music, I'm all in on the guitar for that. That was beautiful. I love that. It's almost like classical guitar. It's not classical, I know, but it's not, you know, twangy folk guitar. So it was really nice. It was beautiful. So that was the Easter vigil. And then for Sunday morning, we got up and went to Easter Mass, the usual time at our usual parish, with Father Matt. It was really nice to have Palm Sunday, Good Friday, and Easter with Father Matt. Because we're a collaborative parish of three parishes, we would normally only see him like one Sunday a month, maybe every 2 months, with just the way he rotates between the parishes and the masses. Yeah. So it was a privilege to get to see and hear him.
Yeah, I think the way they ended up doing it this year was they grouped the English masses together more so than they usually do. So they basically did only three Good Friday services, one in Cape Verdean, one in Haitian, and one in English. They only did three vigil masses, where usually they have multiple vigils,
right,
and stagger the times. But they only did one in Haitian, one in Cape Verdean, and one in English.
And one of the parishes has got a large Haitian community, one's got a large Cape Verdean community, and one is just a large English-speaking community. Ours is the one that's got the large Cape Verdean community.
Right.
So they had the vigil, Good Friday, and Holy Thursday were Cape Verdean at our parish. We could have gone to the other parish. It's on the other side of the city that we're next to.
It's a little further away.
And there are other parishes that are close by that we could have gone to as well. But it's just the way that it worked out. And so that's why we went to Our Lady of Lourdes for Good Friday. But they had the regular mass schedule on Sunday, and that was really nice. And so Father Matt was there for that. And we'll talk about his homily later. But it was really nice. It was packed.
It was packed, and there were a lot of people who were clearly not normal mass goers, people who were struggling a little bit with the sit, stand, and kneel and the responses. And it's always nice to see people who have been away who come back for the holidays.
It's easy to grump like, blah, 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 where are you the rest of the year? Brum, 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 you know, that sort of thing. But on the other hand, these are the people who made the effort. They came. It's Sunday morning. They got up. They came. There are plenty of people who don't even do that. So I applaud people, even if they don't know what they're doing, even if they're chatting through mass or, you know, not kneeling in front of you. So it's hard to kneel in the pew behind them because their back is right there, that sort of thing. I'm OK with that. I'm glad they're there.
And it's nice to see parents bringing their kids.
Yeah.
And
the people in front of us had four kids in the
pew. Yeah. And then the kids weren't quite sure what was going on all the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were learning. They're there. They're learning. Yeah. Hopefully they'll come back.
I heard the mom before mass, the mom explaining to her daughter, probably about Ben's age, I think maybe like 12 or 13, explained to her what confession is. She's like, you tell a priest in a box? all this bad stuff you did? Dad, do you do that? It's like it was kind of funny, just like that she was like aghast at this idea. And then there was the couple behind you who were French.
Yeah, the family behind us was French speaking.
Not sure whether they were from France or Canada or from the French speaking countries in Africa. They were black, so they could have been from any of that. Right. But
Senegal or somewhere.
Yeah, one of the French speaking.
Yeah, the father was doing the prayers in both English and French, but he was doing a lot of the explanations to his son in
little boy, maybe what, six?
Yeah, he was really cute.
Yeah.
He was explaining like the kneeler and stuff, which I'm guessing like their normal parish does not have a kneeler. And so it was really cute. So you can kneel on this if you don't want to kneel on the floor.
My first impression of them was when I turned around for the sign of peace was they were very tall.
they were very tall.
He and his wife were both very tall. And I'm like, wow, hello up there. I get it. I'm not that tall. So everybody seems tall to me, but they were both very tall. But yeah, you caught the French. I was too far away to hear the French.
Yeah, I studied French in high school and college, so I knew enough that I could kind of follow along, like eavesdrop a little bit and catch what they were saying, which is always kind of fun to practice my my French a bit.
So that was Mass. And like I said, we'll talk about Father's homily in a second. But after Mass, we had dinner, and we'll talk about what we had for dinner. And then in the late afternoon, we went over to my brother's house where my family was gathered. And that was a special this year because my niece, I can announce that, right? I think
everyone knows.
Too bad. You didn't tell me not to say anything on my podcast, Debbie. So my sister's daughter, Kateri, got engaged on Saturday, which is awesome. She's like 22?
I think so.
Something like that. 20. Yeah.
She's a junior or senior in college.
Yeah. I think she's either 21 or 22. I'm trying to remember when Evie was married, but then she came soon after.
I think Evie was married in 2000 because it was like a few months before I actually moved to Massachusetts.
She's got to be 21 because that's 22 years ago. So she's got to be 21. Right. But she's been dating this particular boy for
five. They just celebrated their 5-year dating anniversary, but they were friends before they started dating. He's a homeschooled kid and they were both belong to the same
homeschool group,
homeschool co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've known each other for a very long time and it's very sweet. They've been sweethearts for forever. And
yeah,
he's very nice.
So this is now the third of one of my, nieces or nephews who've just gotten engaged. So I've got my two nephews, the one who works for Fidelity, one who's a lieutenant in the army, and now Kateri. And the boys are getting married this year, one in the summer, one in Thanksgiving weekend. And then I asked Evie, she said she thinks that Kateri will be next year. So.
Right. They think she wants to be done with college first before they get married.
Good plan.
Which is not bad. Yeah. I mean, they're still young.
I started calling Pete, my brother-in-law Pete. I started calling him Granddad. just to get him. But yeah.
Not yet.
Not yet. No. But, you know, just hinting at it. It's coming, buddy. It's coming. And then I was talking to my nephew, Dominic, he's not my namesake. He's named after my dad, who's also Dominic. You know, John and Patty were very clear about this, by the way, when they named him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're not naming him after you. We're naming him after dad. Okay. That's fine.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying.
I don't take any offense at that. I'm glad you named him after my dad. Anyway, so he, like his brother, is in the Army. He's actually in ROTC. He's going into his senior year. So he's a junior now. And it was really awesome. I think it's the longest conversation I've had with him. When he was a kid, he was so very quiet and kind of in the overshadowed a little bit by his brothers. He's got, you know, three older brothers who are very boisterous. Yeah,
he's the fourth boy.
Yeah. And so he's kind of overshadowed a little bit, but now they're all, you know, have moved out. And he's at a Providence College. But I think being in the ROTC has boosted his confidence a bit. Or
definitely.
We had a really interesting conversation about his training and what he's going to do and what his plans are. And Just a really pleasant, such a pleasant kid to talk to. They're all such good kids. My brother has done such a great job. I was telling him, my niece Catherine, who's going to your alma mater, University of Dallas, she's such a great young woman. I started talking to my parents, and she's just so good with them. Self-assured, confident, you know.
Kind.
Yeah, just attentive. They're all such good kids. It's really, they've done such a great job. So it was really nice talking to them. And then we had a sibling conversation, my brothers and sisters and I, and the in-laws, you and Carol, and Pete was in the other room, so he was fine. But about taking care of my parents. My parents are elderly. They're in their 80s. My dad's 89. And this is the sort of conversations you have to have when your parents get to a certain age, and, you know, just plans, making arrangements, you know, you don't want to think about it, but it's the way it is. And it's kind of like, oof, I mean, that's the time of life you get to when you have to start doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom is, you know, not well. I mean, she's okay, but she's only going to get worse. And my dad is, like I said, he's spry for an 89-year-old, but he's 89. my uncle Frank is 90. What did we say he was? 95,
something like that.
96 or something. My dad's family are all long lived. Thank God. So, you know, it's nice that he's around. But, you know, but we had, we had agreed that before we came, that we would only stay till six.
Yeah.
Because there's the habit of just staying and on and on and on. When we get talking, we bet and at least just keep talking.
And talking. And talking. And talking.
And it gets loud and very boisterous.
So we were firm in our intention to leave early. And then
Kateri hadn't showed up yet with her fiancé. And
we were told that they would be arriving within half an hour. And so we're like, okay, well, we'll hang out for another half hour.
So we left like at 7. We were there for like 3 hours. That's plenty of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were there to surprise my parents. Although I'm never up for surprising elderly people with anything, but you know, when they have dementia, that's, everything's a surprise over and over again.
Right.
So that was nice. And then we just came home and hung out. The nice thing about like with Easter or any of the big holidays is when you have that late afternoon dinner, you know, that lunch dinner thing, linner,
uh-huh.
Lupper, dupper. I don't know. We have brunch, but we don't have another word. Anyway, you do. And then you go out for like to someone's house for dessert. You come home, you're like, I'm not hungry. You don't have to make another meal, you know?
See, that was hard when the kids were all little because they actually really
were hungry.
They were hungry. They were cranky and hungry before we would even leave to come back home.
Yeah.
And
because they would also be overtired and stuff.
Oh, it was bad. I still really don't prefer the big meal to be in the middle of the day. I prefer my big meal at dinner time.
This is the thing your family does. Your family does the dinner time.
Yeah, meal. My family does not do big meal at lunchtime. We never have. And we didn't usually do holidays with relatives because we didn't generally have relatives nearby.
Right.
For a few years, my Uncle Dan and Aunt Lois lived in Austin, and we did some. And my Uncle Paul lived in Copperas Cove, and we would sometimes do holidays with them. But generally, my family's holidays were us, like our immediate family. And so the whole like extended family going out for a visit after dinner is kind of a culture shock to me because I'm just used to post holiday meal being like everyone goes to their room and like collapses and takes a nap or reads a book or something. And this whole like, wait, now you have to go and be social after I just ate a big meal. I don't really want to do that. And
introvert holiday, extrovert holiday.
Exactly. And I try really hard, but I find it very draining, which is another reason why I'm so tired today. I find it very draining to do a big holiday meal and all the preparation and everything. And go out and like be sociable afterwards.
Honestly, this is why you make it about half of the post meal family gatherings.
Yeah, I didn't make it to Christmas, so I felt like I was absolutely obliged to make it to Easter.
You were.
but it was tough, especially being sick.
Yeah, no, I know. No, I do actually appreciate you making the effort. So we should probably move on and talk about all of the preparations. So we had, so for breakfast, the tradition now, because I've done it once, so therefore it must be done every year, is...
Not just once, you've done it a lot.
I've done it a lot. When we first get up, I will immediately make deviled eggs. And in the past, I've made a dozen deviled eggs. I've taken some of the dyed Easter eggs. How many? We got a lot of dyed eggs.
We did.
54 of them?
Three of the 18 cartons. I can't do the math.
3 times 18, 36 plus 18 is 54.
That was how many eggs we did.
And so I took 2 dozen of those and made deviled eggs.
Your deviled eggs are so good.
Yeah.
I could eat like a dozen deviled eggs.
So the people who liked them are you, me, and Sophie. That's and then Tree was here and she really likes them. And then Lucy discovered that she really likes them. So that's good. So that's everybody really liked them, I would have had to take in all of them and made all deviled eggs.
Bella does not like deviled eggs, but she does like boiled eggs. And so
except for the yolk.
Except she leaves the yolks, the poor abandoned yolks, which I think is the best part. So I really do not understand this whole no yolk thing.
She puts them in a little Ziploc bag and puts them in the fridge. And then I find them later and sprinkle salt on them and eat them.
I told her that she had to do that.
Yes.
No throwing away yolks.
No. So, and it's the simplest. I think it's Cook's Illustrated or somebody's recipe. You know me, Cook's Illustrated. But it's a very simple recipe. You cut the eggs in half. You take the yolks. You put them in a bowl. The deviled eggs, the boiled eggs that you made this year were perfectly boiled. I have to say, they were perfectly boiled. None of the greenish grays. In fact, almost too perfect. Because what you want is you want the yolk to be really crumbly and grainy,
uh-huh,
and like dry. And a lot of the yolks were that really nice, like semi-soft in the middle.
That's how I love them.
It's how I love them, too. If I'm going to eat a boiled egg, that's how I like it. And so I'm like, I really like that she did it this way if I was going to eat these as regular boiled eggs. But it was hard to mash them up when they weren't. And I'm like, I don't want to tell her not to do it this way.
So I ended up doing the boiled eggs because we had so many. I ended up doing them in 3 different batches. I did 1 batch in the Instant Pot. And I figured out the mistake I've been making. I actually read the recipe this time and it said, make sure to cook them on low pressure. The first time I did it, I made sure to cook it on low pressure because it was like the new Instant Pot, mm-hmm, and I didn't know what I was doing. And then after that, I forgot to check the pressure and I've been cooking them on high pressure and that's why they've been breaking.
Okay.
So I lost, I think 2 of them cracked in the Instant Pot. And then the rest I did on the stovetop using, I think it's either Alton Brown or Cook's Illustrated method, but it has you put all the eggs in the cold water and cover them like with about 1 inch of water.
About 1 inch above them.
Above the tops of the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring them to a hard boil and then you take them off the heat and put a lid on them and let them sit for 10 minutes off the heat.
Mm-hmm.
That none of them cracked. I did 2 batches that way.
And they're perfect.
And they were perfectly cooked. So that's the secret. Do not boil. You bring them to a boil and then you cover them, but off the heat.
In fact, I think the latest thing that you suggest is the steam method, because steam is a better all around conductor of heat. There's no hot spots, but that's for that many eggs. That won't work.
Well, I mean, that's what the Instant Pot is. It's steam.
It's essentially is pressurized steam. So what I do is they're cold by this point. You want them to be cold. You don't want them to be at all warm. You want them to be out of the fridge. Cut them in half. Take out the yolk. Mush, crush it up like little fine grains. Then you add a grainy mustard. So this time I used that German grainy mustard.
I love the German grainy mustard. It is my favorite.
Mayonnaise. Mm-hmm. I was kind of wondering if one time I should try the Kewpie mayonnaise, the Japanese mayonnaise.
Ooh, that would be good.
And then I use cider vinegar.
Yes.
And Worcestershire sauce. Worcestershire sauce. It's pronounced Worcestershire. Not Worcestershire. It's Worcestershire. And then salt and pepper, you know, to taste. And
they actually could have used a little bit more salt this time.
The recipe I use does not give any amount of salt.
Right.
So it's all by feel and taste. And it tasted salty enough to me in the bowl, but I could have, my taste buds could have been off. I was also drinking coffee, so that'll mess it up. So
I mean, they were good. Mm-hmm. I just remember them in the past being a little more salty.
Yep. And then I use a piping bag to pipe them into the halves.
So fancy.
It's just easier than using a spoon, frankly. It's just...
See, I hate piping bags. This is my secret fear in the kitchen. I am not good at filling or piping with piping bags. I just make a mess every single time.
The trick is not to overfill the piping bag. Like, you should put less filling in the bag than you think you should. Like, it should never be more than half full, and just refill it as you need to. Because I overfilled it and it was coming out the top on mine. You know, as even though as I was doing the spinning and turning and squeezing, it was still the trick with the, I really wish I could use the fancy star shaped top.
Uh-huh.
But it's not big enough, and because there is still lumps in the yolk mixture, it gets jammed. And so I'm like,
get more tips, bigger tips.
Yeah, maybe. Or just finer, mash that finer, the yolks. But yeah, that might be it too.
Yeah, I made, since my sister has lots of food allergies, I made her some coconut macarons, not coconut macaroons, which use like big shredded coconut, but I essentially adapted almond macaron recipe for with coconut instead of almond, because she can't eat coconut. I mean, she can't eat almonds. So a macaron, they're the little sandwich cookies made with almond, and they're very light and fluffy, and they're so good. And so I toasted my own coconut flakes, and then I ground them up, and you have to very lightly cook the egg whites and then beat them up into a froth, and then you fold it into the sugar and the coconut flour. And then you are supposed to pipe them onto the tray. And I totally made the biggest mess with the piping. Such a mess. Oh my gosh. I should not be allowed anywhere near a piping bag.
Okay.
But they tasted really good.
They did taste good. They were good.
They're very coconutty. Yeah.
You also made a sweet bread, not sweet breads, but like a bread with a sweet filling.
Yeah. So I basically just adapted my normal challah recipe. It's kind of a cross between a brioche and a challah, because challah isn't supposed to use milk and butter, and mine does. And then I filled it with a mixture of cream cheese and almond paste.
Almond paste.
Sweet almond paste.
Right.
Sweet almond paste and a little bit of extra sugar and vanilla and almond extract. I think next time I need to do two blocks of cream cheese, because there wasn't enough of the cheesy filling.
It was, it was really thin. Yeah, you really need to put more in. And it was kind of near the top, so that when you like cut the bread and pick it up, the top would pop off.
I still need to work on the technique, because I cannot figure out quite how to do it so that it...
What if you fold it so that it becomes like a swirl in it?
That's what this actually was, a swirl.
Oh, really? And it just kind of mushed?
It just mushed.
Oh, that's things.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you could roll it.
I did.
Oh, weird.
I basically rolled it like you would make cinnamon buns.
Huh, that's weird.
Except I didn't cut it because I thought about cutting it and making like buns, kind of like cinnamon buns with the cheese and the swirl. But I was a little bit worried that the cheese would just all melt and glob at the bottom of the pan instead of staying in the dough.
Yeah.
And I think it probably would have because it was like kind of opened up at the side and the cheese started to kind of leak out cheese, towards the bottom.
So it'll melt out. It'll move.
I mean, I think the other option would be to bake a bread and then cut it open and spoon the cheese and almond in
and then
after it's cooked.
And then I suppose. Yeah.
I don't know. I can't find a recipe.
I think you need to make many, many more to keep trying.
That tells me how to do this. So I'm making it up as I go along.
Yeah. All right. Then for lunch, let's talk about lunch. We had decided to make a butterfly leg of lamb, which we'd had in the freezer. I picked up had a good deal last summer, which was I'm really glad to have that.
Really?
Ago? Yeah, that one and the other one is in there, been in there for a while too. So I still got one in there. And I'd picked up some strip steaks at the market last week because not everybody likes lamb. A bunch of the kids don't like lamb, so I got some steaks for them. And more of the grilled eggplant we like, which turned out this too smoky this time. I think it actually works better on the propane side of the grill.
I think it does.
Yeah. So what I did with the lamb is I really like having the Middle Eastern flavors in it, like the Mediterranean flavors. So I took some Greek yogurt and harissa paste, which is a spicy pepper paste, and I mixed that along with some rosemary and thyme and a little bit of garlic. And what else? Did I put anything else in it? I don't think I know if I put anything else in it.
I have no idea. I wasn't watching.
And then I smeared it all over both sides and then threw it on the grill. And basically, I built a fire on one side of the grill and had the indirect heat and then put the lamb on the other side. And it cooked really fast. It was a smallish piece of lamb, so it cooked really faster than I thought it was going to. Like, I was going to sear it and then move it to the other side after it's seared and let it build a deep, you know, nice deep crust. But it was cooked through, like it was cooked to 130 really quick. So I'm like, oh, I guess it's done. And I had to, you know, set aside, let it rest. But it tasted good. It was good. You made tzatziki for it. That's the cucumber yogurt.
Except I screwed up and it had way too much salt in it. And
it's a bit salty.
It was too salty.
Yeah. I mean, it's edible still. I mean, I had some for lunch today. It was good.
It was too salty.
But too salty for you. And the steak came out really good. It was really tender.
Yeah. And then we made some squash and some Greek potatoes, which are potatoes that are roasted with
lemon oil
and chicken broth.
Yes.
They're so good.
Oh, man.
I was not very hungry, and the whole meal was just...
We overcook all the holiday meals, and so we've tried to start cutting back a little on the number of dishes we put on the table, and I think it's for the best. Because there's always leftovers anyway. We always still have leftovers. You also made challah.
I did.
And this one didn't rise much.
It overrose.
It overrose and it fell.
It overproofed because I was just too slow getting it in the oven.
Yeah.
Again.
It'll do. It'll happen.
All my baking was a little bit off. I was just not feeling good and I was distracted and.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fine. It was not a disaster. It was a very good meal. Very happy with it. I wish I'd got some wine. I forgot to get wine for the meal.
Yeah. I realized on Saturday and I was just too tired to go to the liquor store.
And I was working. So that was our Easter dinner. So I'm planning on making a smoked pork shoulder for the after confirmation, although I don't know how many people are coming. So I
get the feeling that not very many, if any, are going to actually show up.
Both of my sisters are bringing my mom. And I don't know if Bernie and Carol are planning to bring my dad, but I don't know if Evie is going to bring her kids. So I'll have to ask her to see how many we get coming. I'd be fine if it was just them, my sisters, and my mom.
I think Isabella will be sad if there aren't more people show up.
I know. But I mean, for me, I wouldn't be sad, but it's nice to get together with them. But my other brother's going to visit his son down in the army. So we'll be there. So let's talk about what we've been reading or watching. I just want to mention I watched Ghostbusters Afterlife. Some people said this was a big flop. It didn't do well at all in theaters. I think that's a shame because this was a really good movie. I enjoyed this movie. I mean, it wasn't the best movie ever, but it was certainly better than the Ghostbusters movie of 2016. I'm sorry, but the female Ghostbuster reboot. It was better than that. That one wasn't horrible, but it was sort of a retread, and they just redid the characters as women, and it didn't work well for me, I don't think. Anyway, this movie, Ghostbusters Afterlife, was very nice, very fun. It felt very 80s, very 80s-ish in many ways. I would say the music felt very Spielbergian. The music felt like the incidental music felt like music from a Spielberg movie, a classic Spielberg movie of that sort, of an E.T. sort, you know. You had the plot and the tone of the movie both echoed the original. And in fact, it's a sequel in the sense of it carries on the plot from that movie. Gozer, and you had the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and the Keymaster and the Gatekeeper and all that sort of stuff show up again. Almost to the point where I think some people complained that it was this, they redid the bits that like the big dog creatures chasing down people and invading them and making them into the dog people. And that's the whole, they repeated some of that.
Okay.
But that's okay. It's almost a little bit of an homage. And there's the little girl who is the protagonist, a little girl. She was like maybe 12 or whatever. And was excellent. She was so good. She wasn't just like precocious. And I mean, it's hard to kind of like a lot of the child actors in this sort of thing, like these like Stranger Things, whatever. They're either hard to believe or they're like little adults in child bodies. You know, it could be kind of weird, but she was really excellent. She was believable as a kid, but she was a really good actor. And I really liked her. And she was very much like Egon from the original. Do you remember Egon?
Uh-huh.
For a good reason. I don't want to spoil anything, but, there was some really nice moments that really bring you back. And there were some post-credit scenes, stick around to the very end for a final post-credit scene. If you watch it, and that were really nice and just really made this awesome connection to the original. I remember talking about the Secrets of Ghostbusters on our podcast, Secrets of Movies and TV Shows, a while back, and it was a lot of fun to revisit that movie. And so then to watch this one now was really good. It's really worthwhile. I would really recommend it to people watch it if you're at all interested. It's fun. So then you and I have continued sporadically to watch Raising Dion on Netflix.
Right. We really loved the first season.
Yeah. And this is the one about the little boy and his single mom, widowed mom, who's got superpowers that he's discovered that he's been trying to deal with. And in the first season was figuring out what happened to his dad, how his dad died, and how that's related to him having superpowers. And this person slash creature, super creature, who is coming after him. And how to save him from that. Now, the second season, he's a few years older. We talked about this a few weeks ago. He's a little older, and now he's really seriously trying to deal with these powers in a systematic way. And the super creature, which everyone thought was defeated, is back in a way. And this season isn't as good. And we're trying to figure out what makes this season different.
Well, I think partly the story structure is very different because in the first season, you were dealing actually with multiple strands where you were going back with flashbacks to remembering his dad and his mom, how they met, their whole relationship. And it was all told in flashbacks. And it really made you feel connected to the mom, Nicole. But you also had a lot more about her being a single mom, and she had just moved with her son to a new house in a new neighborhood, a new school. And there was a lot about her getting to know the neighbors and looking for a job and stuff, like coping as a widow after her husband's death.
Right.
And like, I really liked the characters of the next door neighbors who showed up and were trying to help her out and give her advice. And there was a lot of camaraderie there that's kind of missing in this one. And there was a lot more about like her girlfriends in this, in the second season. The only other woman character who's showed up is her sister.
Well, apart from the woman, the CEO of Biona.
Right. But she was, but
the only like friend person is her sister. But
you don't have as much about her. And she was a dancer, and there was like some great stuff about her trying to restart her career as a dancer. And all of that's gone. Like, there's nothing about her personal life, her, except for her relationship with her sister. But there's no friendships.
There's a romantic interest that they're trying to get going.
Right. There's this romantic interest, but I feel like her life feels a lot more impoverished in terms of the relationships. We're no longer exploring her backstory, so we don't have any of the really sweet moments between herself and her husband and the how we met story. And so it's only happening in the present day.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is there was this sense of menace. There's still a sense of menace in this one, but it was a mysterious menace. Like this, who is this creature? Why is the crooked man coming? What is that about? Who is behind it? And they have to, you know, they run, they have to go hide. They have to they have to get away. There was this sense of ongoing peril. This one is very static.
Right. There's not as much. I mean, there's not as much mystery. We were told pretty much from the first.
We know exactly who the bad guy is right from the beginning.
Right. We know who the bad guy is. So there's no real mystery to explore. There's just not as much dramatic tension. There's not as much getting to know you because all the characters are established. Dion and his friends. So he's no longer the new kid in school meeting other kids. It's just a continuation of the friendships and the tension. So there's just a lot more of a second
season. Lull. Yeah.
But without anything to really pull you forward.
But the worst part of it, I think the thing that really drags the season down is that they've made a little boy the bad guy. And it just doesn't seem right.
They're playing on the creepy. There's a trope in horror movies of the
cute, creepy evil kid,
the cute innocent looking kid who turns out to be creepy and evil.
Yeah, think The Shining. Think a lot of movies.
In fact, he actually looks a lot like the boy from The Shining.
I think that's probably intentional.
And yeah, it just. It feels kind of tired. I don't feel like they were doing anything interesting or new with that trope.
But I also feel like there's the inevitable, you see it coming, like the inevitable revelation, it's all this inevitable stuff that you're just waiting for. And so everything is just precursor to that reveal. And it doesn't feel interesting. And then you have the woman who's running the big corporation who turned out to be a good guy, not a bad guy last season. That was one of the twists, is that she's actually really is on Dion's side. And then there's the corporate backstabbing that's about to happen there. And, you know, then you have Dion and his best friend, this little girl in a wheelchair, who's the cutest thing ever. She's like Esperanza, is sweet and everything. And then they're making them have a division that's caused by this little boy, Braden, who, you know, is a creepy mind control kid. And, you know, it's just like, I don't know. It feels
a little contrived,
standard, tropey, cliched, and all those things.
It didn't have the freshness that the first season had. Yeah. And I keep hoping that it's going to turn around, that maybe they're just getting off to a slow start and then it's going to pick up the pace. But we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. Yeah. So we're halfway through. I think we just watched episode 4. I think it's like 8 episodes. So we'll see. We're not making our way through it very fast. So we'll see how it turns out. You said you're reading a new novel?
I'm reading a new novel. This one's been on my shelf for some time. And so I no longer remember who recommended it to me or why I bought it. But I decided that my thing right now is going to be trying to read some of these books that have been sitting around on the shelf for a while. It's called Poor Banished Children. And it's about a woman who is Maltese, as in from the island of Malta. And I'm not exactly sure when it's set, but I think it's probably
17th century.
Okay, so 1600s, right? She ends up shipwrecked in England and doesn't really speak English, but she's been taken in by a Catholic family. And there's a priest who's with the family, but he's in hiding because Catholicism has been outlawed. And so she's kind of confused as to why this priest is wearing, like, normal clothes.
Right.
And her story kind of, she's been shipwrecked, and she doesn't really speak the language, and she's very ill. And her story unfolds as she makes her confession to the priest. And it turns out she's had an incredibly traumatic life. And she spent some time as a slave. She was taken from her village as a young woman. And she spent a lot of time as a slave somewhere in, I think, North Africa, like the Barbary Coast. I think she was taken by corsairs. And so the story kind of is moving forward in her recuperating in this manor house in England while her traumatic childhood and traumatic young adulthood unfold in this. So we're getting both the backstory of her as a kid and then also what happened to her as an adult. It's interesting because, like, if you told the story chronologically, I think it would be very grim because she goes through a lot, both as a child and as a young adult. And I think the fact that we're beginning knowing that she's going to survive somehow gives us some hope to kind of hold on to as we're going through her story. She had been just trying to begin religious life with a community of anchorites, like discerning a vocation when she was captured and forced into slavery. And this is really some harrowing stuff going on.
Mm.
And the novel is not really pulling very many punches. So she's been through a lot. But it's really good storytelling. And there's several different priest characters who are very attractive. There's the priest who finds her and takes care of her and teaches her as a child. Then there's a priest character who rescues her as a slave. He's there and trying to ransom slaves, and he isn't able to ransom her, but he's able to kind of be a protector when she first arrives and comes off the ship. And then there's the priest who's hearing her confession. And I really like the fact that these characters are all very sympathetic priests, and we're hearing their their points of view about her life.
This is an Ignatius Press novel, so it's from a Catholic press.
It's from a Catholic press, and the author is herself Maltese, by family of origin. I don't think
Her name is Fiorella De Maria.
Right. Interestingly, so I got curious about, like, more about Malta as I was reading, and the Maltese language is actually a Semitic language.
Mm-hmm.
It's Arabic, but it has been Latinized. I'm fascinated by that.
So Caroline and Lindsay from Catholics of Oz are they're Maltese. Their family's from Malta.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, and they've been to. I'm pretty sure they've been to Malta, but they know a lot about the Maltese culture and language and all that sort of stuff. So they would probably enjoy this.
Yeah, I'm really liking it. And it's kind of fitting in with my Lenten reading. I'm also re-listening to the audiobook of The Goblin Emperor because I loved it so much. And the audiobook is really good. If you haven't read The Goblin Emperor, which I talked about a lot when I was reading it last year, check out the audiobook.
Mm.
It's such a good story. I this is one of those stories I think I can reread multiple times and still continue to get a lot out of it.
So this book came out in 2011. The author, she's written now 10 books. Her 10th novel is out. And at least 10, she might've come up with another one since. And she's written, three books or crime novels with her Benedictine monk turned detective Father Gabriel. So a sort of Father Brown sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm based on this book, I think I will definitely be looking up some more of her fiction. Really enjoying it.
Yeah, I think the author, I think she's British, but she's of right. But she's of Maltese heritage. So cool. Excellent. So yeah, she's had
somebody must have recommended it to me at some point because I bought it.
Yeah.
But whoever it was, if it was you, let me know because I would love to say thank you. Sometimes I buy books and then when they arrive, I'm in the middle of something else and I don't get around to it and it sits on a shelf and then until I discover it again, I'm like, why do I own this book? I don't know. Let's see what it's about.
Okay. I like this. I found an interview with her from the National Catholic Register and it's, they posed the question to her about the concept of a Catholic crime writer. Should Catholics be writing fiction about people murdering each other? And her response is she pretends to groan before saying, unfortunately, I think that there was a tendency within the world of Catholic publishing and writing to feel that good Catholic authors should write sanitized little propaganda pieces about sweet old ladies baking cakes for the parish fete. And you know what? I really like her.
Yeah, right. I agree. I think that there is a tendency to want fiction to be a little bit too neat and tidy and pretty when, in fact, Catholic fiction should be grappling with questions of sin and
human nature
and fallen human nature and the need for redemption.
Yep.
And I feel like this, the protagonist, I don't want to give away any of the plot points. She has a lot to grapple with. And I appreciate her character being a very complex character who has to deal with a lot about sin and temptation. And she, it's good. It's not easy. Yeah. It's not.
I might be interested in her Father Gabriel mysteries. I might pick one of those up and check it out.
Yeah, I like mystery novels.
Yeah. All right. So that's what we've been reading and watching. So let's talk about a little bit of what we heard at Easter Mass in Father Matt's homily. Father Matt did his usual bang-up job. You know, that it's that homily every year where priests are expected to give that homily that will call back all the people who are there just for Easter. And yet also provide something meaty for the regular mass attending Catholics as well. It's the impossible job that everyone expects of the priest. But Father Matt did a pretty good job. And the line I remembered from the homily was, the devil will have his hour, but God will have his day. And that day is today. And I'm like, that's a good line. That's like a movie tagline.
That is like a movie tagline. I know that I was really hanging on the homily and I thought I was like sufficiently wide awake. I did not need to take notes. I kind of wish I'd taken notes, but what I remember most was Father Matt was a Marine chaplain.
Well, no, he's still a Marine chaplain. He was a Marine.
Like he was a Marine.
A Marine officer, before he entered seminary. He was in the Marines for a number of years. Then he became a priest and then became a reserve Navy officer and Marine chaplain. All the Marine chaplains are Navy officers.
Right. So anyway, he talked about how like he is a reserve Navy officer, but he's never actually been on ship.
Right. He said, I know enough that you call it a ship and not a boat. And I've been on two ships in my career, and one of them was two commissioned ships in my career. One of them was the USS Constitution, so that doesn't really count. And the other one was tied up to the pier.
Yeah.
And if we ever got in a sailboat and I was the captain, we'd both be dead.
Right.
But
then he talked about, and this was really great, how an old fashioned word among sailors.
For a navigation term.
Navigational
for
term.
For sailing toward the rising sun.
Is Eastering.
Yes.
So Easter can be a verb. And I really, if you want to win my heart, like give me cool.
Start talking about linguistics.
Give me cool linguistic tidbits and I will love you forever. I really liked this idea that Easter is a verb, to turn towards the east. It works really well too. I love the way it ties into the Christmas season when we celebrate one of the O antiphons is, which are the titles for Christ, is O Oriens, O East. And so Jesus is our east. He is our guiding star.
He is the rising sun.
Right. And
which works so well in English, rising sun.
Right. And so the idea that, like, to turn to the east, to turn towards the rising sun, to turn towards Christ, is to Easter.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. Isn't that beautiful?
We should, as the Easter people, we should Easter. We should turn toward the rising sun, turn toward Christ.
And that he is that which makes everything else make sense.
Right.
Like, life can be confusing. Life can be grim and dismal. But Jesus makes it all make sense.
Yeah.
And I really, that just really hit me as, like, you know, and Father Matt reiterated something which has been a sort of a theme for me, which is, look, you might have had, like, a really bad Lent. You were not really doing it all. But here we are. It's time to celebrate. Jesus is risen.
No matter how your Lent went, how you think your Holy Week went, it's time to celebrate. You have permission to celebrate no matter how well you did. Like we were talking about last week, where he was talking about, you know, no matter how your Lent has gone, take this opportunity with Holy Week, you know. And the homily, who was the homily was from, the ancient homily?
John Chrysostom.
John Chrysostom, who, you know, said, he compared it to the workers in the vineyard parable. You know, if you showed up at the beginning of the day or you showed up right before the quitting time, everyone is equal right to the same pay, because that's what the master of the vineyard has decreed. And in the same way, if you showed up on Ash Wednesday, or if you showed up on Easter Sunday, we all get to celebrate in the same joy, the same way, with the Easter joy. Speaking of Easter, though, he did mention that it's his custom, and I know you appreciated this, that he does not say Happy Easter until Easter.
Until Easter Sunday. I did appreciate that, because I noticed actually on Good Friday, as we were walking out after the Good Friday liturgy, that there were a bunch of
little old ladies
who were all saying Happy Easter.
Happy Easter!
And I'm like, I don't want to be rude to them.
Yeah.
But I just do not want to say Happy Easter to people.
Too.
I just smiled and nodded.
Yeah.
I smiled and nodded. I wasn't rude to them. I would never be rude.
Right.
But
it's not being rigorous. It's not like being like a stick in the mud, like, it's not yet Easter, Jesus is still dead. You know, it's more of saving the joy for the time. Like, when you save up, when you wait for the right time, it's even better.
For everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. Mm-hmm. Good Friday is not the time to, it's not yet. It's not yet time to celebrate Easter joy.
It sort of reminds me of Father Murphy talking about the strawberries in season during marriage prep.
I do not remember that.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was awkward. That felt awkward for Father Murphy to be talking about waiting for strawberries in their season. You can use your imagination what he was referring to.
But there is something really satisfying to me about that waiting for Easter joy. I mean, one Lent, I gave up reading fiction for Lent, mm-hmm. which is really hard for me because I love fiction and I am not really a nonfiction reader. And one of my favorite novelists came out with a new novel that arrived, the package arrived during Lent, like 2 weeks before Easter. And that book sat in its envelope in my room.
Calling me.
And I resisted nobly. And then after the Easter vigil, like, it was late and I got home and I opened up that package and I read the first few chapters, and it was so lovely to finally be able to break mm-hmm. my fast and enjoy the feast with a good book from my.
But it's why we fast. It's why we give things up. It's not just to punish ourselves. It's to remind us of what joy there is when the good thing comes. That's part of it. It's to remind us of this is, remember, this is how joyful, like your joy eating that burger or, you know, that chocolate or drinking that beer or smoking that cigar or whatever it is you've given up as your discipline for Lent, that joy you're feeling at experiencing that is a tenth of that joy of the Easter joy, of the real, the Christ is risen.
This is why I know a lot of people say it's very childish to just give up sweets for Lent. And once or twice, I tried as an adult to not give up sweets for Lent. And what I found was that the Easter candy just didn't have the same savor. It was kind of disappointing, honestly, to have not given up sweets because it was just like more sweets.
It just was. Yeah, it was just, oh, well, sweets. Yeah.
And so I always like I try to give up. I mean, I try to impose other Easter disciplines, Lenten disciplines on myself as well. But for me, like a baseline is I don't eat sweets during Lent because I love Easter candy as that breaking of that 40 days fast. And like, oh, the chocolate is so good. And the jelly beans and oh, the cookies and the cakes and everything. And I can just enjoy it wholeheartedly.
Mm. By the way, speaking of which, I have to say, I think I did pretty good yesterday with the sweets and other things. I did not overindulge. That's I'm very proud of myself. In fact, when I weighed myself this morning, I had lost 2 pounds.
So, that's impressive.
Yes, so I'm happy with myself.
I probably eat too many, but
yeah, it's a celebration. I don't blame anyone for indulging on Easter Sunday. In fact, that's what my doctor always said. Is like when it comes to holidays, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, go ahead and indulge a little. Just, you know, don't indulge on non-holidays, but holidays, you know, as long as not every day is a holiday, just indulge on the holidays. So anyway, Easter joy. And I wish Easter joy to everyone listening. Certainly Easter is just beginning. That's one thing I love about our faith. Easter isn't a day. It's not even a week. It's a season. And we're just starting that season. So
really speaking of indulging in the treats. That's where that I always have a hard time is like, I want to celebrate for the entire season, but I need to pace myself.
Yes, you do.
So I'm still trying to work out the best way to keep that Easter joy without it being all about like dessert every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there
are other ways to celebrate.
There are other ways to celebrate, but yeah. I still haven't quite found the perfect, like I haven't found my pace yet or the perfect way to make Easter continue to feel like a celebration.
I mean, for me, part of it is just as the spring comes and, you know, things bloom and blossom, it feels joyful to me. Throwing open the windows and getting the fresh air and seeing the leaves and the hearing the birds and all that sort of stuff is part of the Easter joy for me. So it might be getting outdoors more as the weather permits, I think is a way to make Easter joy without all being all about food. So. Anyway, we should wrap there. So we want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Lisa V, Victor L, Joey F, Michael B, and Daniel R. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. That's it from us. You'll find links from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. You can send your feedback at the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send us an email to bets@sqpn.com. And now visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.